Emergency warning systems are on all our minds this week, and people all over Hawaii have been asking about the ways federal and state agencies communicate with one another in fast-breaking events like last Saturday's nuclear missile warning. To get some answers, my co-host Catherine Cruz spoke with Brandy Richard, a spokeswoman for the Region 9 Federal Emergency Management Office, FEMA. They spoke about a wireless alert system known by the acronym IPAWS, which stands for Integrated Public Alert Warning System.
What can you share with us? Can you give us like a 101 on this wireless alert system?
The IPAWS system gives alerting authorities a single interface to send emergency information to radio and television as emergency alert system broadcasts. It also works on cellular phones as well as wireless emergency alert text and other communications media. And the IPAWS system itself is a FEMA product that is created to support nationally for states and locals to be able to send these messages across. We typically don't issue alerts. Rather, IPAWS enables authorized federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial officials to send those. And we just provide the infrastructure, if you will, for them to be able to do that.
So these aren't really texts then? They just go over our wireless phone system? Is that correct?
They can be text. It depends on how you are engaged with the system or the information that the locals or states have to be able to push the information across to a text or to just your phone, kind of like an Amber Alert. It depends on what you're allowing on your device and what you've tied into as far as your local or state communications are concerned.
Well,
for instance, in my city, I may have access to sign up for alerts from local government, or all of the alerts may be sent on that automatic system. But if I've opted out on my phone or if I've turned off those Amber Alert type messages on my phone, then I don't have access to it.
Okay, and that's an important point because we were hearing a lot from families that, my wife got it, I didn't, or vice versa, and it's the same wireless company, wireless carrier, and it really all depends on how you've configured your phone.
Absolutely, and it's personal preference, but I know in Region 9, we encourage individuals to sign up for local alerts, for state alerts, to download our FEMA app. There are lots of different ways that you can get information. And so it's really important when a crisis hits to be able to get as much information as possible. But sometimes it's annoying if you receive an alert that, you know, interrupts your sleep or something like that, and then maybe you turn the system off for your phone. So we really encourage individuals within their cities and within their states and counties to avail themselves of whatever alerts are being pushed through those governments.
Okay, so that's a really important point for the general public. Given we had the situation on Saturday, check your phones, figure out if you've got that alert on so you can get important messages about disasters or whatever.
You can get an emergency alert system broadcast to your cellular phone, a wireless emergency alert text message, or other ways of communication. I know for me, I want to make sure that I'm tied into everything, so I would encourage your listeners to go out to their cell phone company and just make sure that they've set up the ability to receive the alerts that come automatically over your phone, regardless of if you have text alerts or something like that set up or not.
Okay, so there's the Amber Alert, there's the emergency alert that you might get from the city and county or the state. And isn't there a presidential alert?
So any alerts that come through utilize the same system, but the issue is on your device, are you able to receive the information? So when you talk about the different alerts, like if the president were to request that an alert was sent out across the IPAWS system, how someone accesses it, maybe through that same type of Amber Alert where it just takes over your phone and you hear this loud, that lets you know that there's an Amber Alert And it's regardless of if you're on the phone. As long as your phone is on and receiving a connection, you would receive that alert regardless of which type of an alert it is.
Okay.
And so the important thing is that you have that enabled on your device.
All right. Yeah, I know we do get occasional alerts about flash floods, weather alerts, that kind of a thing, you know, depending on where that alert comes from, what county you're in here. If you could talk a little about the flow of information between the feds and the state, how does that work?
So we do not hit the button that sends an alert out. What we do is have the infrastructure in place so that if a local or state government official wants to send an alert, they can do so. And so there isn't like a check and balance for those alerts between us at the federal level and individuals at the local and state level. We've just provided the infrastructure in order to be able to send alerts out.
Okay. But I would imagine in a situation like we had with the missile false alarm, people are saying, well, it would be the military that would get the first heads up that something was amiss and then would transmit that information down to the state and the counties.
At the end of the day, the most important part is that the people who are closest to the incident, whatever that incident is, and a nuclear incident is definitely different, so there is military involvement there, but the people who are closest to the incident have the ability to be able to send out a message. Now, beyond that, we want that to be in place. Like, we want people who are closest to an incident that happens to be able to send out an alert to all of the people near them to say, this is going on and we need you to take action. That's part of what your local and state leaders are there to do. And so because this didn't come from a military source, I think the most important reminder for people to know is that it's a good thing that you will get an alert that lets you know if something happened. We're just going to make sure that we're all signed up and we're able to receive them so that we can get them.
Right. And there are multiple investigations ongoing now as a result of this mistake. And we hope to straighten out the protocols. I know one thing that's frustrating just as a cell phone user is these upgrades that happen. And sometimes you upgrade and you're going, oh, wait a minute, I have to relearn my phone again. I was under the impression that I didn't get the second alert canceling, you know, the first alert that it was a false alarm. And my son showed me this morning on my phone, no, Mom, you've got to swipe up and then you can see all your old alerts. And it was like, oh, okay. So it's challenging when you get an upgrade and you're starting from scratch again almost.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's just a part of our preparedness as individuals and as families to take it seriously. I think this incident allowed us to shine a light on the fact that these alerts are there, what their purpose is, their importance, and ensure that more of us make sure that we know how to work our phones and know how to access the information and also know that it's important to sign up for these alerts because the world that we live in, I mean, over 2017, we had so many natural disasters across the country. They're just things that you would need to be updated on very, very quickly and making sure that you can navigate this wonderful technology that many of us spend quite a bit of money to put in our pockets and carry around.
That's right.
To provide that type of support and assistance for you and your family to keep you safe, I think is just really important.
Brandy Richard is a FEMA spokesperson for the Region 9 office, which includes Hawaii. All this week, we've been asking you to share your experience during last Saturday's false alarm, and here's some of what we heard.
Hi, my name is Shane Barlow. I'm from Kailua, Oahu. And when I got the message, I was 12 nautical miles offshore on Penguin Bank fishing. I got the message within 2 minutes. Fortunately, I had reception. My first thought was how much fuel I had to be able to run the Molokai and how much drinking water I had. And then, of course, the sorrowful thought that I might be witnessing something tragic. And just trying to assess the best decision forward to not only be safe for myself, but then possibly with my boat return to Oahu and provide as much assistance as I could to people that would need it. Fortunately, the Coast Guard did make a radio call within 20 minutes to inform that it was a false call. Hello.
Hello, this is Pearl Johnson. I live at Pohainani in Kaneohe, a senior retirement home. On the day of the false alarm, I was in another room for my phone, but I heard the beeping from my phone. And when I got back to it, I saw the alarm. But I saw that it was 7 minutes old and that there were no sirens going, nobody running around. So I went down to breakfast. I think that without the sirens and a whole lot of commotion, I thought there was no need to be alarmed. Bye.
Hi, this is Greg Colbert calling from Kailua. At the time of the alert, we were just arriving at a popular breakfast spot, and what we found were that people were leaving the restaurant, but some of the people leaving were actually just upset and leaving with food still on the table and in some cases bills unpaid. Ultimately, though, because this is Hawaii, it was reassuring that as people understood that it was a false alarm, people were trickling back in to pay unpaid bills and apologize and often sat down, reordered, and had breakfast that morning.
You can hear other listeners' calls during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And if you'd like to tell us about your experience with the erroneous missile alert or anything else, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on HPR. You're listening to statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a young Hawaii scientist is selected for a groundbreaking NASA mission. But first, your quiz. Today, we'll take a look at a shipwreck that remains off the coast of West Waikiki. Many advanced divers know the ship, now known as the Sea Tiger, to be filled with marine life. It also offers exploration through its inner cabins, engine room, narrow passageways, and stairwells. But the 189-foot ship did not always lie 123 feet beneath the ocean. The Sea Tiger was intentionally sunk in 1999 after it was caught smuggling 98 illegal Chinese immigrants into Hawaii. The five crew members responsible ended up serving years in prison, as the seizure was one of the largest of its kind at the time. The Sea Tiger was taken by the Justice Department and sold at auction. Throughout its time at the bottom of the Sea Tiger has grown to become a tourist attraction for those who seek a little more adventure than snorkeling at Hanauma Bay. But the Sea Tiger was not always the name of this famous shipwreck, and that's the name we're looking for today. Can you tell us the original name of the ship that lies at the bottom of Waikiki Beach? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative, Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working, and Eye Doctors Hawaii.
It's the dream of every scientist to explore territory no one else has seen. And it's coming to UH graduate David Truong, who's been selected as a participating scientist on NASA's first asteroid sample return mission, OSIRIS-REx. OSIRIS-REx is en route to Bennu, an asteroid approximately 1,600 feet in diameter orbiting in the solar system. They'll take samples of the asteroid and return them to Earth. David will work with preliminary survey maps of Bennu, gathering data that will help scientists understand how planetary bodies are formed. For David Truong, it's the culmination of a love of science that began in childhood.
When I was a kid back in, I think it was like second grade, and we were in the library and we were kind of walking around. You had to check out a book. You know, you're a little kid. You have to get into reading and stuff like that. And I remember walking around and looking at these different books, and when I found these books on all these planets and how we have pictures of all these different planets, yeah. I was just like, oh, no way, you know, this is too cool. So, you know, flipping through the books, it's just so exotic from Earth, because when I was a kid, I always looked at, like, maps of Earth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's so different, and that really caught my eye, and ever since, I was like, this is what I want to do, and I've been kind of following, you know, as much as I can and reading up on it as much as I could, so it was... It's always been my thing.
Well, those images, you know, they're not only beautiful and, you know, the colors and everything are mm-hmm. incredible, but they're kind of mysterious, right? They draw you in.
Yeah, and it's just things we've never seen on Earth before, or they're very uncommon. It's just, and of course, the colors always help and make things a little bit more beautiful, especially when you're a child.
Yeah, sure. But that part of you that was originally stimulated by those images, it gets kept alive as you become a serious, you know, pursuing science, right?
Oh, for sure. I still have these memories back in the day of seeing, like, an entire global map of Venus and just seeing how weird that is. It's still with me, and even the work that I do today, when I go through images, you know, I'm always awed by how beautiful our solar system is.
What kind of things can you learn from the images? You kind of analyze mm-hmm. images. And that's a simplified version.
Right, yeah, we do. We have all sorts of data coming from instruments. Each one tells you a little bit different things. For example, the electromagnetic spectrum, ranging from like the visible light to near-infrared to thermal-infrared, they tell you all sorts of different things. And you take all these things together. You can make measurements. For example, we know like the distances that we're seeing on the maps. You can measure, like, example, boulders and craters. We also have laser altimeters that tell you the topography, so we can actually start measuring different sizes of like craters and volcanoes and such.
How far out from Earth? You know, are these planets in the solar system?
So usually we're using like spacecraft data to understand, like, for example, the moon. So these things are in orbit and they're doing these measurements. And it's really amazing, especially like in the near-infrared and thermal-infrared. We can even get composition. We can figure out which minerals are there.
Near-infrared and thermal-infrared?
Yeah. So we're talking about things that are in like these wavelengths are in the 1 micron range, uh-huh. All the way out to like tens of microns and hundreds of microns. So it's just really cool to use this data to understand our body without having to land on it.
Not visible to the naked eye, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But what does it tell us about, what, heat, temperatures?
The thermal infrared tells us a little bit about temperatures as well, so it's another way of getting an idea of how big rocks are without actually, you know, visually measuring it. We can actually tell how big it is by something called what we call thermal inertia, so basically how fast does these rocks lose heat. As, for example, for the moon, as it goes into the night, small rocks will lose heat much faster. So we can tell that, you know, the surface is mostly fine-grained rocks, where big rocks take a long time to lose heat. Yeah. So throughout the night, it's still, like, releasing that heat, and we can detect that.
Now, you wouldn't think of using a not visible to the naked eye data mm-hmm. to extrapolate that kind of information, or a civilian wouldn't anyway.
Right, yeah, and it's amazing because even when we go all the way out to like radio wavelengths and radar, it's great because we can penetrate the atmosphere of Venus or one of the moons of Saturn, Titan. We can actually see the surface, even though you can't see it with the visual eyes because of all the clouds that are covering on top. But with radar,
you create a really accurate image.
Yeah, they're really accurate and they're beautiful, and you know, it's something we've never seen before, and it's always, you know, surprises us whenever we look at these bodies.
Can you tell color as well, even though there are clouds?
Not with color. Usually, you know, it's just one wavelength, and you're using a wavelength that's
shapes,
not in the visible.
Shapes, but not colors?
Right. It's mostly, like, topography and stuff like that, yeah.
Can you extrapolate what the colors might be? Educated guess?
When we're looking at, talking about, like, Venus or Titan, not really, not without seeing things invisible light.
Yeah.
You can't really figure out without having that visible camera in there. So, and because we can't see with visible, then we can't get the colors, that's unfortunately.
That's where the science fiction writers take.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, if anything, when it comes to science fiction writers are the ones that really, you know, lead the way in recruiting people.
They do seem to fire the imagination.
For sure, and, you know, it definitely helps fire my imagination as well, and helps me become and stay excited as well.
One of the things about astronomy that I find fascinating are these, you know, concepts that test our very ability to understand anything. And I'm talking about things like the pondering where the edge of the universe might be, the mm-hmm. whole idea of the universe having the universe ending, or, you know, having an end point, having a beginning, you know, in time. Taking on ideas like that, does that continue to fire your imagination?
Not so much. I have. I really love sticking with planetary science more than going a little bit beyond. And part of that reason is, you know, we actually have images and of planets and seeing how unique and beautiful they are. A little bit beyond that, it's just so mind-blowing that I can't even wrap my head around it. So it's really hard to just kind of imagine. But I do love it. Like you said, it's still amazing, but it's so much for my head to wrap around.
Well, in a way, it's reassuring for me to hear a scientist say that, you know, because you do think that it challenges your ability to understand. But you prefer data that you can really work with and what you can get from that data.
Right. And I just like seeing, I don't know, I just love looking at maps. That's always been my thing.
Yeah. How does that dovetail into this project, the asteroid sample return mission?
Basically, we've never been to this asteroid. So the OSIRIS-REx mission is to go to an asteroid called Bennu. It's about 500 meters across. And we have some images of it from Earth-based telescopes and stuff like that, but you know they're not very high resolution. So the OSIRIS-REx mission will actually come approach this asteroid for the first time, and when we get there, it's going to be amazing. Basically, it's something that we've never seen before, and you know that whole mystery. It's like opening a Christmas present. You don't know what's going to be there. You're excited, and in some ways, it's like with the telescopes, it's like shaking a Christmas box. You know, you have an idea what might be there, but you don't exactly know until you're actually there. So, seeing something for the first time, that's just amazing. You know, I don't know how to describe it in words and how excited that is. Yeah. You know, how excited I am to do this.
Are the data coming in all at once?
So when we go to Bennu, so we will get there late fall this year, and we'll be orbiting for a year. So we will be getting images for over a year, collecting data as well. And then the sample return will happen about 2020 in the summer. So a little bit of ways from now still, but, you know, we got to take that time to actually collect the data and understand it.
So you're going to be kept busy for a while.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm excited, really excited, so can't wait.
David Truong is a graduate of the University of Hawaii at Hilo, where he earned his Bachelor of Science, and at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where he earned his doctorate, completing that in December of 2014. He was selected as a participating science for the OSIRIS-REx mission to help broaden and complement the expertise of the team by analyzing data, providing maps to help in sample site selection. You can find out more at the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii's State Department of Land and Natural Resources has no problem understanding the reality of climate change. DLNR Director Suzanne Case says its impacts are already being felt all around us, and its potential impacts are nothing less than catastrophic. Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle has more in today's reality check. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
What did this was from a news conference yesterday by DLNR. What kind of things did they say that they hadn't said before?
You know, they talked about everything from how climate change is going to impact our forest and how it already is, to all the way down, you know, it was Mauka to Makai, all the way down to the ocean and how it's wrecking our reefs and the things that we should be doing but aren't doing yet to address these.
One of the things I thought was really striking was talking about some of the inland flooding that we've gotten used to seeing in heavy rains as that being one of the impacts of climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. Suzanne Case said that the king tides that we saw last summer, you know, our seasonal tides, are kind of a preview of what's going to come, and those are going to be more severe and more frequent.
What would be what was proposed as a mitigating measure for that, for example?
They didn't talk about a lot of mitigating measures for that, but they did talk about efforts to just across the board, from reforestation, taking kind of a global look at, you know, trying to sequester more carbon, you know, the ultimate cause of all this, to smaller things that we can do around the coast, such as measures, for instance, to maybe control the amount of herbivorous fish that are caught, such as uhu or parrotfish.
Because why?
Those fish, the reefs really depend on them to eat the algae that kind of takes over after coral bleaching events, which is another effect of climate change. Mm-hmm. So you need those in the water, and you need strong numbers in order to give the corals a chance to kind of come back from those events.
The measures that the kind of things that they did talk about are needing to do, they're all going to cost quite a bit of money, aren't they?
Quite a bit of money. We're talking billions of dollars. Just sea level rise alone, in addressing, you know, our coasts, moving roads and protecting buildings, things like that. They're estimating, you know, $19 billion just conservatively.
Over what period of time, Nathan?
That would be between now and 2100. The shorter term, between now and, say, 2050, is a couple billion, somewhere in that range.
But it's obviously a serious amount of money in a political climate where there are a great many other demands on serious amounts of money, right?
You're absolutely right. And the thing they keep trying to stress, though, is that is a lot of money, but it's going to be a whole lot more money if we wait and keep kicking this down the road.
Unfortunately, that also applies to other government expenditures, right? If we spend some now rather than a lot later, that's a pattern we see recurring, don't we?
It is. It absolutely is.
Nathan, thanks very much for this, and we'll be keeping in touch about that.
Thanks.
That was Nathan Eagle with today's reality check from Civil Beat on The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
Normally at this point in our Friday show, we talk with our news director, Bill Dorman, about stories the news department is working on for next week. But this is the end of a pretty extraordinary week, so today that conversation is going to be a little bit different, and I guess we both know what that's going to be about. Bill.
Yeah, aloha, Chris, sure is. You know, as you know and as you've been talking about, asking our listeners to share some stories about their experiences and thoughts on Saturday, and a number of folks have basically said, hey, what was the story at HPR?
Yeah.
Why weren't you broadcasting live throughout this whole time? And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that, what happened and why, and how
sure.
We're taking another look at what we do on mm-hmm. procedures and protocols and all that.
People turn on their radio when there's some doubt about what's going on, right?
Exactly.
You go to the nearest broadcast outlet, and yep. What do they got to say?
Exactly. And so that, again, a lot of folks have mentioned there was something very unusual about that Saturday, this alert from the start, it did not trigger the emergency alert system. That's a pretty huge one. The sirens that in places we would expect to go off did not. And our immediate sort of upon getting the reaction in terms of getting that smartphone alert was what journalists do. You try to confirm information, confirm how do you know what you think you know, where does this come from, and especially given that unusual situation in terms of that. And we are staffed 24 hours here. As it happened, Jackie Young, our weekend news person, was here doing weekend newscasts. Other folks, of course, out throughout in town and trying to confirm and get information. Emergency Management Agency, along with thousands of others, of course, we weren't able to get through to confirm that from where it was. Folks on news and talk trying to get other word online. We did get, for example, a military source saying that it was a false alarm, but not able to get that on the record, not able to confirm that with a second source, and most importantly, not able to get confirmation from the source from which this came in terms of the emergency management folks. So while we were not on the air with all of this, we were going on with this, and I did want to just say thanks to our staff for jumping in on this and following up in the days since with different story angles and reach outs to the listeners, adjustments and programs and plans and all of that. But I do think that one of the takeaways for this, one lesson for me, is to bring the listener along with us, you know, hindsight 2020 and all of that. But it would have been good for us to break into programming and say an alert went out on smartphones, but we have not been notified by the emergency alert system.
We're trying to confirm. Bear with us.
Exactly. And that idea of here's what we know, here's what we do not know, here's what we're working on. But again, bringing the listener along in that process rather than waiting until we have the complete package and information. As it happens, we were able to do that. But again, I'm the news director. Take responsibility for that. We're going through our procedures and protocols. And
Captain of the ship, right, Bill?
You betcha.
Thanks very much. That was Bill Dorman, HPR's news director.
Swing to the Latin and salsa rhythms of Freddie Miranda Jr., drummer and percussionist extraordinaire, and his quintet of all-stars. Make your reservations today for their Atherton studio debut on January 27th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for the Freddie Miranda Jr. Quintet. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
The American Disabilities Act of 1990, known as ADA, set a standard for public accommodations for the disabled, things like elevators, hallways, and doorway access points that need to be built in such a way that a wheelchair can get through. But that's the physical world. You might not realize that the ADA extends to the virtual world as well. Our in-studio guest is Francine Wye, director of the Disabilities Communications Access Board, to talk about how a website needs to be, under the law, ADA compliant, right?
Correct.
Francine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm trying to get my head around the whole idea of something intangible, like a website, being ADA compliant. What are the things that need to be addressed?
Well, it's very interesting. With just a little bit of historical perspective, when the ADA was passed, the Internet was really not a viable service, or at least it wasn't to the general public.
Yeah.
So when the ADA guidelines were first established in 1991, and they were promulgated by the Department of Justice, there was no such guideline or even mention of the word Internet digital access.
Yeah.
We talked about the physical world, the building, which everyone's familiar with, curb ramps.
Staircases,
right? Well, people talked about disabled person parking. Mm-hmm. People talked about sign language interpreters. People talked about Braille. People talked about service animals, all those things that we could literally go up and touch.
Mobility and communication.
Right. But as you know, life has evolved over the last two decades, more and more of how we offer services to people is through the internet and through the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we're going to talk today about website accessibility, but there are also other ways in which we get things through the digital world as well. We get things through television. We get things through Apple Watches. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's really a huge world out there that was never contemplated by Congress or the people who drafted the ADA regulations. When you try to access a program and service of state government, almost everybody goes to www.hawaii.gov or California or mm-hmm. U.S. Department of Justice, wherever you might want to access. Or even if you want to buy something from Amazon, right? You don't walk to an Amazon store. Mm-hmm. You go online. So the web in particular has become the lifeline for people.
Well, let's say I have a little store, you know, a physical store that also has a web mm-hmm. presence, and I want to be able to sell things online. What do I need to make sure I'm compliant with?
Okay. Well, I think we all think or know how the internet works. So when you have a disability, you're primarily but not exclusively talking about people who have communication access needs. So you're talking about an individual who is blind or low vision. And when you look at the typical person looks at the website, they take their mouse and they kind of visually glance through the website.
Sure.
But you can't do that if you're blind or visually impaired. So people rely upon what are called screen readers. And screen readers will voice whatever is on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine that in order to maybe see what's at the bottom of a scrolled screen, your screen reader will just voice to you everything that it sees on the screen, absolutely every word.
How do you do that? How if you're creating a website, how do you do that?
Well, I'm not a tech person. I'm not a web developer. But there are very specific standards, and these standards come through what's called the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the W3 Consortium, and they're called the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So they tell you how to develop a website so that it can be read by a screen reader. They will tell you how to use graphics and photos so that someone who is blind will have what's called an alt text behind those photos, because you won't necessarily know that this is a seal of the state of Hawaii or mm-hmm. a particular graphic. So the people who code the website know or should know how to put what's called an alternate text behind, so that the screen reader would read, this is a picture of...
A voice would actually, you
yes,
would hear a voice say
you would
say
hear
it.
A voice say it. Your screen reader would say that. And if you have something that is animated or it has voice to explain, this is how a product works, then what you would have is a caption or an explanation for someone who is deaf who can't hear that.
Francine, I'm betting that I could find a lot of websites as I sit here in front of my laptop now that are not compliant.
Oh, absolutely.
And thousands.
Thousands of websites, because...
What are the consequences?
Right now, web access is being litigated very heavily in court in all across the United States, primarily from blind groups, although I want to emphasize that the standard isn't just about people who are blind or low vision, because we're talking about having content that is audio be available in print format for someone who's deaf or hard of hearing. There are also guidelines to make sure that for people who are low vision that you don't guide somebody by saying, choose the red button, because if you're colorblind, you can't distinguish between the red button and the green button, as an example. Don't design a website so that the background bleeds through the text and you can't differentiate if you have low vision. Use certain types of font. Don't, in fact, use visuals that are so dramatic that they can induce seizures. You may not think about that.
It sounds as if there are a great many things that
right.
we may not think about, but it sounds as if we might have to start pretty soon.
Yes, and people who have mobility disabilities who may use voice activation or who may only use a keyboard, you have to be able to design all your commands so that they can be activated in that manner rather than using a mouse to search on the screen. Everything has an alternate way.
I suspect that a lot of people are rethinking their web design on the basis of that. Francine, thanks very much for
talking
with us.
Thank you. It goes very quickly. Thank you.
Francine Wye is the director of the Disabilities and Communication Access Board. The public is invited to submit comments on draft amendments to communications access for persons who are deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind. You can find the link to do that on the Conversations Facebook page. Earlier, we asked you about the original name of a famous tourist attraction at the bottom of the ocean off West Waikiki Beach. The ship was originally seized by the Department of Justice for illegally carrying 93 immigrants. It was then sold off to the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society for $40,000. They planned to use it to harass and ram fishing vessels that laid drift nets to catch fish. It was then slated to be renamed UN Resolution 42-126 after the United Nations resolution that banned drift nets. The society's plan fell through, and the Yun Fong Siong number 303 ended up selling in 1994 to a Vietnamese fisherman who renamed it the Sea Tiger. That was the name of the ship we were looking for, and perhaps not too surprisingly, no one got that today. But that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, hosting its annual literacy conference January 29th through February 1st on Maui, Oahu, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Achieve3000/community/events.
Today's performing careers for classical music artists are often born in competition, as pianist Joyce Yang's was with her silver medal finish at the 2005 Van Cliburn International Piano Competition when she was 19 years old. For her, it's a life of constant travel, performing ensembles around the world, learning to craft performances with an ever-changing cast of musicians. Along the way, there are opportunities to inspire and instruct aspiring musicians through master classes. Joyce is in Hawaii to both perform and teach. She's with us in our studio. And thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your career took off when you were 19 years old and in a way that perhaps you did not expect. Is that right?
Right. When I entered the Van Cliburn Piano Competition in 2005, never thought I'd walk away with the silver, which gets you about 4 years of constant traveling.
Uh-huh.
And as a youngest contestant, I didn't think that was going to be the one that propels me out into the world. And to my utter surprise, I ended up as one of the last standing contestants. And the amount of exposure it gives you, it's just shocking.
What went through your head when it hit you that this was going to change your life?
I think The most shocking moment was going into the office right after the medal has been put around my neck, and they showed me my schedule for the next 3 years. And really? It was like, well, you're going to do 60 to 80 concerts a year, and all these people have signed up to hear the silver medalist, which until 5 minutes before that had nothing to do with me.
It's just that quickly? I mean, there were all these gigs lined up before they knew who the silver medalist was going to be.
Exactly. So when I get to, especially the first year right out of the competition, you go. And you go to perform and you open the program book and there's nothing in it about me. It just says, you'll hear the silver medalist.
Oh, so it's all laid out for you in advance.
So you suddenly have to fulfill the role of the silver medalist. And until that point, I thought I was doing pretty well as a freshman in college. Everyone seemed to be encouraging me, telling me I'm doing a good job. Yeah. And suddenly you get compared to the greatest pianists living today. And then they want to know what your philosophy is and what you want to say through music. And at age 19, you're just in for the ride and you don't know what you stand for. So it's a very mind-boggling time.
Well, I'm wondering if your success at the competition maybe had something to do with the fact that you weren't in it to win it. You thinking that you were, had high expectations for yourself. Did that help you relax in a way?
I think I was pretty relaxed until I went into the competition, and unfortunately I made the mistake of hearing about 30 contestants before I played my first note, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm the worst one here.
They were all great, right?
They were just all stunning in different ways. Uh-huh. And I was performing things maybe for the first time, the first round that I had to present. These were new pieces, and I hadn't really nailed down everything I wanted to say. So, but I remember my teacher going, these people are here to win, but you're here to perform. Play like you're in your big living room, that's how you play anyway.
Yeah.
So make sure, you really make music and just have a good time. And I think that changed many things, but there was one point where I thought I made the most terrible mistake in the left hand, and I remember thinking, gosh, how embarrassing. I'm the one contestant that made this terrible little flaw, and I knew at that point I'm not going to move on to the next round. So from that point on, which was about 20 minutes into my recital, I started to really have a good time.
Might as well.
Yeah, might as well. And I think that might have really made me stand out, because I was just literally not playing to win. I was like, I'm just going to give it all I've got and really make music. And from that point on, I was not nervous. So I really had fun toward the end, I remember.
There's so many performers that could benefit from that state of mind and from that advice. And you reach proficiency in a practice room in a school, and then all of a sudden you're put into an environment that really can interfere with your proficiency, because your muscles tense up and your heartbeat increases and there's all these people sitting there, and none of that is conducive toward giving your best sitting at the piano, right?
Absolutely. It's a totally different feeling, especially when there is a moving camera that is internet televising, and God knows how many people are listening and watching. And what's even more nerve-wracking is even worse than, a huge concert hall filled with people, because aside from the audience, in the first tier, you see the bright lights that the judges have over their, they have a spotlight so they can follow along the score.
They're reading the score.
So you know that this is really like, like an audition after all. So it's very hard to relax.
So when you make that horrible mistake, they're all looking at the score that tells what you should have played.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was a piece by Liszt, so they would have known it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, well, of all people, right?
Yeah.
So it's about as demanding for a pianist as any composer.
Yeah. You know? And I know I got really nervous because that's the only time I walked on stage. And I had played, you know, many concerts leading up to that point. But that was the only concert where my legs went numb. I could not feel my feet. So, yes, I was nervous. But somehow I came off pretty playful. They saw me as the young soul that was there to have a good time.
Well, which you were, you know. And Joyce, I hope your Hawaii performances don't hold as many terrors for you.
I am really greatly looking forward to it. The chamber music process is an interesting one. It really awakens a part of you that really need to connect with other musicians, and to be able to create something together is a great joy.
It's great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Thanks.
Pianist Joyce Yang will perform a program of compositions by Russian masters with the Tresemble at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater on Monday, January 22nd, and a private dinner concert with the Galliard String Quartet the evening before. Both are presentations of Chamber Music Hawaii, and you can learn more about them on the Conversations Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. We'll be joining you on Monday morning, which is also the day of the Governor's State of the State Address, and we'll be getting our perspectives on that to you during the week. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkrug. Join me and Catherine Cruz on Monday, and we'll pick up The Conversation.